Hey, hey, hey. Pop Culture Quorum Deo. This is Jeff. Thanks for tuning in. What you have in front of you is one of my favorite interviews ever. Being a podcast host has its demands for sure, but it has been good to me as well. In particular, podcasting has let me interview some of my heroes and also some truly fascinating people. Owen Cyclops falls into that last category. I read two great books this year, Susanna Clarke's Piranesi and Owen Cyclops' first collection of comics. When his book, titled Channel One, The First Collection of Comics, which you can check the show notes to find a link to that book, when that released, Owen said he would be open to coming on podcast to talk about the book. I leapt at that chance, and some friends of the show told him it was a good idea, and lo and behold, he said yes. What followed was an open-ended conversation that hit a broad array of topics, and, as I mentioned previously, resulted in an interview that ranks at the very top of the many I've been privileged to conduct and enjoy. Truth be told, I'm fairly new to Owen's work, so if you're like me, then let me try to sketch out what he does and what the forthcoming interview will be like. According to his Twitter bio, Owen is an illustrator and mystical idiot. He's a comic creator, but think less Garfield and the Peanuts gang, and more like a confluence of Gary Larson from The Far Side, that Welcome to Night Vale podcast, and Michael Heiser, starting to communicate in a visually distinct style. We talked about everything, how he goes about creating comics, cryptids, conspiracy theories, symbolism, and semiotics, all kinds of stuff. If you read the Our Hideous Strength material on Servants and Heralds, you'll eat this up. One heads up, Owen writes comics for grown-ups, so his material deals with grown-up topics. When you pick up his book, for example, you'll find an extended comic about his porn use and how he continues to fight against it today. What you'll also find is some of the most interesting and honest content coming from a Christian creator today. All right, enough intro. Let's get into my interview with Owen Cyclops. Enjoy. Hey, Owen Cyclops, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I am delighted to have a chance to talk to you and really appreciate your time. How are you doing today?
I am doing great, man. I'm very happy to be here. I'm glad to be here, man. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm delighted you accepted the invitation. So, I mean, what prompted this is you just released a book of your comics. You know, if I were a better person or a better host, I would have written down. It's called Collection One. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's called Channel One, The First Collection of Comics. I just released it. It's on Amazon. If anyone's interested already at the start of the show, you can search my name on Amazon. But yeah, it's really fun. It's kind of exciting for me because it unintentionally became this close of the chapter of this really large body of work that I've been doing at my studio here. So yeah, it's a really fun time for me.
Well, I'll just put all my cards on the table up front. I came to you and your work through an image of yours where you have what I assume is some kind of divine woman cutting the head off of an alien.
Yeah.
A friend who knew some of my interests was like, you need to check this out. And I thought, whoever made this is someone I'm interested in. Then I found your Twitter account and from there got exposed to your comics. So I think I can say this as someone who's coming from this pretty objectively. I've read some good stuff this year. There's a book called Piranesi I have loved that I read this year. But your collection of comics is one of the best books I've read all year, man. I couldn't put it down.
Oh, awesome, man. I'm really glad you feel that way. That's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's going to make great reading, listener. So if you're looking for a good book, and I mean, people are going to get Amazon gift cards for Christmas. Put your money here.
Cool, man. Yeah, I'm really glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that image because people often ask me, you know, what I do or what my vibe is, so to speak. And it's sometimes kind of hard to pin down, but I feel like that image of this, you know, sort of like you said, divine woman, like cutting the head off this gray alien, something about that really crystallized an aspect of my artistic vibe, and it went pretty far. It really went out to some circles, and I actually have a photo of this guy. He's wearing the shirt, and he's talking to some like nuns in Peru, and like pointing to the shirt. So it went pretty far. I captured something there, I guess, which is a nice thing as an artist.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess I didn't realize how much resonance there was with some of your interest in the esoteric, with what I thought was really something that. It was kind of a niche that me and some, you know, a select circle of my friends were super interested in. But we, you know, the friend who sent it to me sent me that image about the time we had spent, you know, a couple of weeks talking about aliens being demons. And we're like, oh, somebody has encapsulated this in a perfect image. You know, it was delightful.
Yeah, that's funny. That idea itself was kind of like a big breakthrough moment for me. I feel like it really did come to maybe not prominence, but it sort of became a thing, at least in online circles with people who are interested in weird manifestations of religion or weird things in general. I remember a few years ago, I had to dig like pretty hard to even get exposed to it. And then now a lot more people are talking about it. So it's kind of interesting how things happen like that.
Yeah, for sure. So another version of that is the same group of friends. We've just been plowing through missing 411 videos on the Mr. Ballin YouTube channel. And so we've just been, you know, churning through those. And it was when you were kind enough to send a digital copy of your comics over. And I read the comic you wrote about watching those videos going camping before and after watching those videos. And I was like, guys, Owen is in our head. I mean, apparently there's more interest in that than I knew, and which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think the missing 411 stuff is a really awesome, I don't really want to call it a gateway because it is really a thing like in and of itself. But for me, that was a really big, I guess I'll use the term gateway. It really opened up a window into the paranormal aspect of things for me, because maybe like most people, you know, I heard of ghosts and, you know, things like that, but it's ultimately always one person just saying this weird thing happened, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not. There's no way for you to verify it. But with the missing 411 stuff, because it's actually a case and there's this real person and here's this, you know, documentation of it, I think that really makes it a lot more interesting, honestly, and a lot more like, wow, this really happened. And then David Pilates, as you probably know, doesn't really posit his own theory as to what happened. So it's this really awesome body of information, and then it just leaves you hanging with no explanation. So it kind of invites you to step in and say, okay, like, you know, what's going on here? It really, really sucks you in.
For sure. I wouldn't violate his bodily autonomy this way, but wouldn't you like to know, like, somebody injected him with truth serum and said, actually, what is your theory?
Do you know he used to be like a Bigfoot guy? Do you know about that?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Oh, dude. Yeah, it's crazy. Like I'm pretty sure this is the story, but it's something like he saw Bigfoot. Oh, no, it's something like this. He knew these two guys. There was a rich guy who saw Bigfoot when he was younger, and he found some other super rich guy who saw Bigfoot when he was younger. And they both got really interested in figuring out what the reality of it was. And I think they hired him as a private investigator to go into it as like an objective detective to figure out what the story is. And somehow going through all those cases led to him pooling all these missing persons cases, which led to missing 411. But if you search his name in Bigfoot, he has some like pretty out there presentations on it.
Okay, so I'm 100% doing that when we get done.
Cool.
Group of friends I was telling you about, we've just been churning through Sasquatch and Dogman stuff like the last couple of weeks. So yeah, I'm definitely doing that.
Awesome. So you guys know about Dogman. That's like the cutting edge cryptid in my mind. That's like the next big one, you could say, coming over the horizon.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the operating theory we have right now is that this is the degenerated offspring of the Nephilim project. So we're hashing it out.
Yeah. Nice. We'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so what I'm hoping to do is have a conversation like we've been doing already, but to stake it to specific elements in your book so that anyone listening maybe could treat this as like a guide or at least a conversation walking them through your book. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to just start at the beginning with some questions and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, sounds great, man.
One thing I wasn't expecting when I jumped into your book is how autobiographical it is. You know, I was expecting something like a Watterson collection of Calvin and Hobbes and whatnot. Again, I'm coming to your comics late. But this, I feel like I really got to, I don't want to say get to know you, but I got to know a lot about you as a person from this. Obviously, you're a guy who thinks very carefully about images. You're obviously very wise about protecting your offline privacy and whatnot. And so there was a juxtaposition for me where this is a guy who, you know, is meaningfully keeping some things out of the public record, but was incredibly transparent about his inner life. And so was that a conscious decision to say, like, I'll let you in, but you're not, you know, you don't get to know the form of the person that you're coming in to kind of pick his brain. Does that question make sense?
No, definitely. Yeah, no, it's definitely intentional for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of things there. I mean, I've been doing art for a long time, and something kind of funny, I don't normally talk about it, but something kind of interesting is that I used to be more tangentially you know, right on the edge of or hanging around, let's say, like the normal art world where, you know, just normal artists, you know, people, they're great people, but, you know, people doing art in a more normal capacity. And what's interesting is that at that time, this is a really long time ago, I really rebelled against this idea of like having to showcase yourself and make it about you. And like if you go to an art gallery, there's always like an artist statement and it'll talk about, you know, the person's history and you're viewing the lens through the person themselves. And initially, I really rebelled against that because I was like, you know, I just want people to see my images and not make it about me. You know, I started using a fake name. I was like, I don't want it to be about this guy, you know, wearing this shirt. Just look at the picture and experience it, you know, in a pure way. And I really tried to ride that wave for as long as possible. But on the flip side, there's another sort of stream of development there where, you know, as an artist, you're kind of pontificating. You're sort of telling people something. And eventually I came to the conclusion of, you know, I'm not really qualified to pontificate or teach about many things, but I knew this guy that said there is one thing you're an expert in more than anyone else, which is yourself and your own experience. It's almost the only thing that you have 100% unique view on. So those two things together kind of wrap up in that question. On the one hand, yeah, it is about me, but then people don't really know who I am. So there's like a funny paradox there. I also think being online, especially as an anonymous person, I don't know if how many people listening are in that world, but especially as an anonymous person, there is a fork in the road you hit eventually where either you lean in 100% to being a persona, which involves, you know, sort of pretending to be someone you're not, maybe in a good or bad way, or you fall the other way and kind of say, you know, yeah, I'm actually just a normal guy. Like I work at the supermarket and I do this for fun, you know? And I really fell on the other side of, you know, being open of like, yeah, I'm figuring out how to do this. I'm doing art. Like I'm this guy. I think a big part of that is why I started posting and putting my art out there in the first place, which was I really felt like I was just in this unique place. I talk about it in the book a little bit of being hit really hard with the, especially at that time, what word do I want to use here? With like the spiritual damage and like the psychological stress of being out of step with the culture around me. And I thought, you know, the least I could do is reach out to other people and kind of articulate something about this experience that I'm not seeing articulated. So all that kind of wraps up in that question. So on the one hand, yeah, it is about me, but on the other hand, it's more about these things that tangentially relate to me. So yeah, it's a fine line that I walk intentionally for sure.
Do you find unique temptations in being a public figure behind an intentional kind of wall of privacy? Because I'm thinking about like a whole bunch of people have been going through for a decade now, going through and thinking, man, what have we gotten into with social media? And one of the common tropes you hear is, oh, well, we act differently online because there's not a meaningful relationship to our real life, right? We're you know, the common one is you're meaner. You're definitely not a mean Twitter guy. And so I just wonder if I know in your book you say, like, I think I found integration to some degree between my online persona and who I am. But I mean, do you find other temptations? And that's open-ended. You may not. I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's been a long time, maybe like 5 or more years or so of really running, I guess you'd call it this project, but it's really myself, which again is just strange. You know, yeah, that is like a common trope people say of like, oh, you know, people are meaner online because they're anonymous. I suppose that's true. I really do come at it from the opposite perspective. Maybe it's because of my background, but I feel like the anonymity really provides a unique sense of honesty, because at the end of the day, even if, you know, let's say I got super famous as Owen Cyclops, that is who I am really. But when I go to a dinner party and I introduce myself with my real name, it's like that there's a break between those two identities. So at the end of the day, when I come home and I'm doing art and it's Owen Cyclops, I'm not doing that for my own self-aggrandizement. And that, I think, frees up a lot of space for honesty, because let's just say I was like a university professor or something. There's really no way to separate what I'm doing under my name and what I'm going to my job as. And then, well, there's a tendency to maybe go with the flow too much. Maybe I shouldn't say this thing because I have a student who works in this field, or maybe I'm just saying this to get in with this crowd so they'll publish my book or something. So not that there's anything wrong with that, but for me, I really lean on the side of it conferring a unique type of honesty. It's divorced from my everyday legal name life, and yeah, that lets me kind of say whatever I want. And I guess I could be mean, but for me, it's kind of the opposite. It's like I'm able to just be who I really am. It's kind of a cliche, but, you know, it's like you give someone a mask, they'll show you who they really are. For me, I really experience that 100%. I can go online, do whatever I want and not worry about, you know, what my grandma's going to say or what my mom's going to say or, you know, and it happens to manifest in a wholesome way. Maybe I'm just a wholesome guy. I kind of lucked out, I guess.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
No shame in that. Well, I think, you know, as a reader, I've benefited from that honesty. And I think that, I mean, again, just looking at it through my own eyes as the expert on me, that honesty is kind of the gateway to connect with your word. You have a comic about, I mean, basically your relationship to sex over the course of your life. And I remember reading that and being like, gosh, I just resonate with that so much. And when I was asking about like your transparency, I really appreciated that. And that's been a temptation with this preview copy you've sent me, because I'm like, I know people who would like be encouraged by this stuff. And so what I'm doing, instead of just cutting and pasting that and sending it to them, I'm like, look, either buy this book or I'm going to buy it for you. And then we'll have a conversation about it. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny actually mentioning that one. That's another just weird little note in terms of what I do, because I got kind of lucky in that I put the comics out digitally, and then the incentive to obtain them is that it's really nice looking at them physically. But it's also funny because part of what I do is, like I said, you know, I guess you could call it like a form of outreach in a way, or getting a certain type of vibe out there. So it's funny. Someone emailed me and they were like, hey, you know, can I send this comic to my priest? Like, I think he would really find it interesting. You know, he doesn't know about like internet pornography, of course. So it's funny. So I have them online. They're in the book, though. So it's this weird paradox again of like I'm trying to show it to like literally everyone. And then there's also the physical manifestation of the book. But yeah, that comic's another perfect example, man. You know, if I had my real name and my real face on my Facebook profile, am I going to go post like, hey, I used to have this problem and now I kind of still have it, but maybe you guys do too. And then if I did that, people might see that as, oh, you know, Owen's just looking for sympathy, or Owen's trying to be this. Oh, he's trying to make himself look like this nice guy. So it's almost like it's only by being this totally anonymous person that I can really do that in like a pure way, at least from, you know, from my particular vantage point. I know people with their real names do it too, but that was the easiest way for me to do it.
Sure. Sure. Well, I guess now I'm going to have to just go rake your Twitter feed to see what all you've put out there. Some of the stuff you've written, I'm like, I don't know what date this was composed. It showed up earlier in the book. One of them did, where, you know, there's a guy talking to someone about how people always lie and people in power lie. And as soon as you say, oh, scientists will lie, he stabs the guy speaking in the chest. Yeah. And I thought, well, now that's prophecy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny in terms of my, yeah. So some people obviously probably don't know about me or my like background in any way, but yeah, I mean, the short arc of it that really fits in with that comic is that part of my genesis was that I was living in New York City and I was really in the maximum level of, I don't really want to use the word like liberal, because it's not like really about that. I mean, that tangentially relates to it, but just this kind of like particular way of thinking that I was out of step with. So a lot of it was about me working it out of my mind and having these people around me. There is another whole comic in the book where it's like I explain it to something to someone and they say, I guess, yeah, but then they still act like it's incorrect, or just hitting these mental walls. And I think it kind of makes sense if you see what I do now, that I spent really like years just banging my head against wondering why people around me were thinking in a certain way and seeing things in a certain way and it negatively affecting my life. I used to post a lot more about that, but, you know, yeah, like losing friends over it, or having, you know, weird relationships with family members, even though you haven't done anything wrong. I'm sure most people can relate to that in some capacity. So yeah, it's funny. The book really spans from me being there in that situation, like literally being in this like dirty Brooklyn apartment, all the way to my wife getting pregnant, which isn't covered in the book, but it's a nice, neat little arc of like me stuck in the dirty apartment and now I'm about to have a kid. It really closes and starts this nice chunk of my life.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I'm gonna ask you about Comic X here in a minute, because in another one of those, you know, pleasant coincidences, about the time that you said, hey, I'm about to release a book, if somebody has a podcast, you know, hit me up, maybe I'll come on. I had found Comic X through your Twitter feed, or someone had sent it to me. And I was like, man, holy cow, that's as relevant as like my week this week, you know?
Yeah.
So that being said, before you get to that in your book, you point readers to the King in Yellow story.
Yeah.
And I guess listeners, if they're aware of this, maybe they came to it the same way I did. I didn't know about that until HBO released their True Detective series, season one. But the way you describe it is, or what you fascinated on was, hey, there's this piece of art that if you read it, you'll go crazy, which sounds like Lovecraftian stuff, and that idea captivated you. But as I was reading you say that, and then going back and reading the book, and then coming back to that essay for this interview, it seems to me more like your work is aimed at helping people fight their way out of insanity. Is that a fair summary? I mean, do you think I'm onto something there, or
yeah,
do you
definitely
think about yourself in that way?
Yeah, definitely. There's, well, it's kind of interesting because that flip is also a big part of like what I'm about in a way, because yeah, so I got really obsessed with that idea. It kind of fits with other things I do because I've always been very into, you know, religious texts in general, which it's not the same thing, but it fits in the idea of like reading something and changing how you think. And it's a really, really funny example, but I'll just take it there. So at that time that I made that, there was a lot of like conspiracy theory stuff kind of breaking in the media in terms of, wow, oh my God, I bet you literally can't believe that this NFL player thinks that the earth is flat. Or, wow, I bet you can't believe that this NBA player thinks that dinosaurs aren't real and stuff like that. That was like, for some reason, like for a few months, that was like a big media thing, I guess. And what I really noticed was that, you know, so of course I would read the article and be like, all right, let's go. Like, I'm definitely interested. And they'd say, you know, yeah, I watched this video and it kind of convinced me of X, Y, and Z. And what I really noticed was, A, I found that super interesting. I was like, all right, well, I'm going to watch it, obviously. I mean, if you're telling me there's a video this guy watched and now he thinks the earth is flat, I'm obviously going to check that out. But I noticed that some people around me had the opposite reaction of just, wow, you know, that's really crazy. And then I'm never going to watch that. I would never check that out. And it really made me realize that like the people around me sort of had this weird, some people had that mental barrier and some people didn't. Maybe it's not a barrier. Maybe it's, you know, dumb to be interested in, but some people had that feature and some people don't. Where if they hear something that sounds kind of crazy, they're like, okay, I'm definitely going to turn that rock over. And if some people hear it, they're like, well, only stupid people are turning that rock over. I'm not going over there. And I think that somehow that was a really big part of me getting interested in that, because I just got really fascinated by the idea that, oh, there's like information that you can put in your brain. And then all of a sudden you're like not the same person and you can't really see things the same way and you can't talk to people the same way. And they start to act like you're really dumb, even though you're maybe even not even putting something forth. Maybe you just have like a genuine question, you know? Tying it back in a little bit before. So when I was living in New York, I also was around like a lot of people that were sort of experts in their own fields. I had like a really weird job where I happened to be interacting with all these people that were like kind of at the middle of their fields, let's say. And it was funny because, yeah, I'd get these questions and I would ask them. And they would kind of have the response of like, you know, you're dumb for asking me that. And I'm like, well, I'm just trying to figure it out, man, you know? And I think that what you said about trying to make people feel more sane, that's something that's really, really interesting to me, because I hit this point where I still actually am in this place. Maybe it never ends. But where it's like, I almost feel like the smartest questions you could ask, some people interpret them as like the dumbest questions you could ask. And then you're floating in this space of like, well, am I the idiot or am I really smart? I can't tell. You know what I mean? If I'm asking questions that are like, well, you know, like here's a great example, just to make it concrete. I was on this call with one of my wife's friends the other week, and she was talking about how she's not sure about certain things about reality. And she picks up this book and she's like, well, you know, here's one thing I am sure about, you know, gravity is real, obviously. And she drops the book. She's like, I can see that gravity is real. And it's funny because I was talking to someone and they were like, well, you know, the theory of gravity is like relatively recent. Ancient Greeks dropped things and saw them fall all the time and they didn't have a theory of gravity. So what's the deal with that? And I'm like, wow, that's so interesting. I've literally never thought about that. But if you start asking questions like that, people are like, what are you, an idiot? Like, of course gravity is real. And you're like, well, yeah, I'm not saying that, but isn't it interesting, you know? So I hit this space where it's like, well, yeah, now I'm asking these questions and I can't tell if I'm the dumb one or if I'm the smart one or if, you know. And playing with that boundary and how it manifests, you know, in the comics and what we're talking about is really, really interesting to me. And it always keeps resurfacing. Like if you ask certain questions, people treat you like an idiot. But does that make you dumb? Maybe you're dumb for asking. You can't tell. And then you're floating in this space of like, well, now I don't know what's going on.
Well, that aspect of Comic X, I think, is what makes it so immediately relatable. I mean, we're living in a 2-year period that I don't know when it's going to end, if it does, but where like everybody is having to deal in some way with this mostly immediate evidence that people in charge are willing to lie to get what they want done. And so I think that that comic's probably going to have a long tail in relevance, because there's a whole bunch of people who are taking some step on that, the journey it documents every day. But the thing that, I mean, it really hooked me when I was looking at that comic for the first time, was that it's not just people being like, hey, you're stupid for asking this question, but there's this visceral hostility that that they respond with. And I thought, yeah, where does that come from? Because I grew up kind of government school educated, and I feel like kind of in the common intellectual, you know, environment of my age, and questions were treated as a good thing. Like that's how you found out new stuff. But somehow it flips hard. And you mentioned in that comic, like, why is there this arbitrary line, and how do I know everybody's arbitrary line, and how do I relate to them until I find it? That comic doesn't end. It's just you reading a book towards the end there. Have you made any advances after that? Like, have you figured out how to nudge people better?
Well, it's funny. The plan was to like have that be a whole book, but then I got to that point and I wasn't really sure how to continue. There's a painter, he's named de Kooning, and he says, great works of art, you don't finish them, they just kind of finish themselves eventually, or you just stop working on them. I don't think that's always true, but that was the case for that one. have I made any progress on that? I feel like I understand worldviews and how worldviews function in people's worldview. That's a repetitive and weird statement, but kind of makes sense. But have I made any progress? Honestly, I feel like I've kind of like come to terms with certain things more. I really have realized that there's a term, it's called the obsessive epiphany, where it's a really good term if you're into anything that we've talked about so far, because it's probably happened to you, where you learn about something and you have this what's called an obsessive epiphany, and you're like, oh my God, I literally have to show every person this. And once I show them, they're going to get it, and we're all going to walk into the rainbow universe where everyone gets it just like me. But it literally never happens. You can actually see it play out like on a historical stage, even, you know, even with something as different from what we're talking about as like, you know, I always think of Timothy Leary, where you take acid and you're like, wow, once everyone takes acid, everyone's going to get it. But it just doesn't work that way with anything. So I really lived in that realm for a while, and I really, it's kind of what the comic's about, but I kind of just so badly was like, I just need one other person. Like, it was like I'm holding this circle and I'm like, look, this is a circle, and everyone around me is like, it's a square. And I'm like, I just need one person, just one person. And it just didn't happen. So I kind of understand it more. There's this Confucius quote, actually, odd parallel, but that really helped me out, which said, don't worry that other people don't understand you. Worry that you don't understand other people. And I feel like eventually I became a lot more compassionate about it. I kind of realized that, you know, a worldview really is a whole totalistic, systemic thing. So if you have all the puzzle pieces and then I come in the room and I'm like, hey, can you just jam this in somewhere? It doesn't fit, but just jam it in. It doesn't really work that way. And I became a lot more compassionate about it. I kind of realized you can't really force people. But honestly, mostly I've just kind of structured my life so I don't have to be in a kind of situation where I'm constantly taking this like psychic and like spiritual damage. That's another reason why I made that comic, kind of weaving in and out of a few topics right now. But that's another reason why I made that, is that people are probably in different spheres online listening to this. But there's a whole kind of man sphere, masculinity, how do we be men and stuff like that. And I feel like one piece that was really missing from that is like, it's pretty painful to be out of step with the people around you. Ultimately, you know, maybe it's because, you know, being a man, people don't like to kind of put up like a facade of like weakness or whatever. But it really is kind of painful to like have someone in your life and they just can't integrate their worldview into their worldview. And you have this dissonance or hostility and you can't tell if you should just lay down, which kind of feels bad. Maybe that's like lying. Am I lying if I just kind of pretend I don't feel this way? Or am I forcing the issue and like ruining the relationship with my grandpa or something? It's pretty painful, honestly. So I've kind of come to terms with that. I've accepted a lot of it. I put myself in a position where, on the one hand, I don't feel weak, like I'm lying to people, but on the other hand, I'm not forcing the issue. So yeah, you could say I've come to terms with it more and I understand it more, but efficaciously, No, honestly, maybe my whole art project and what I do online is part of that. Just kind of putting my vibe out there. And if other people want to go deeper, they can. But I don't think you can force people ultimately, which is, I guess, what I was trying to do for a while. Or maybe they were trying to force me and I was pushing back. It's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. And even like the worth of the project, like I'm a Christian. I think I need to share the gospel. That's a different level of importance than like, now, how do I get this person to be open to the idea that Dog Man is running around in somebody's woods? You know, there's a different level of importance. It's interesting. I mean, you talked about masks earlier and how the Owen Cyclops mask kind of lets you live a more authentic life. But I mean, that Comic X is the other side of that mask process, right? Like sometimes the masks are up to just keep you from having to run into something that would be really painful. And there's no solution to it. You just, you know, just try not to step on that bear trap because you want to hang out and watch a football game or whatever.
Yeah. And I really had this kind of epiphany. And whenever I talk about it online, there's young men who instantly DM me and they're like, they message me and they say, wow, you know, this is me. But I kind of realized that because I was putting on this mask all the time, I was also sitting around wondering why I didn't feel very close with people. And I was like, oh, it's because, you know, it's a catch-22. It's because I'm putting on this mask. So I can't complain they don't really know me because I'm not showing them the real me. You know, it becomes this like really painful back and forth loop. So, yeah, it's a really interesting topic. I should revisit it. But I think most people, especially now, it's definitely revved up in the last few years. I think most people have experienced something like that. So it's become, maybe it was back then, but it definitely is universal for sure.
Yeah, well, that's my theory for what it's worth on Comic X, that it doesn't have a nice tight ending because you and, I mean, honestly, a whole bunch of others who resonate with it are still living through it. You know, we're still, maybe there's a gain in like just coming to terms with it or finding a few people that don't make you feel like you're crazy when you just throw the idea out there, but it's still kind of, it's still ongoing. So yet to be written.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you this probably a couple times, but do you read much C.S. Lewis? Is he on your radar?
I have not read much C.S. Lewis. It's actually interesting. I have a funny backstory with him because I read the first Chronicles of Narnia book when I was really, really young, and I had the self-awareness. I remember reading it and thinking, wow, this is totally insane, but I'm just a little too dumb to actually understand it. I must have been like really, really little. And I remember like a few images from it, like statues and like these ponds. And I was like, man, this is next level, but I'm not getting it actually. And I never went back to it, unfortunately. But now that I have a kid, it's really hardcore on my radar. I mean, the second the baby can read, we're hitting it first day.
Well, I commend that choice, brother. I'm a Lewis fan. And there's something else later on I want to kind of toss to you, but he writes about friendship, and he says the essence of friendship is finding another person to whom you say, oh, you too. And that like friendship is always, it's not looking at each other the way lovers would look at each other, but that friendship is looking at this other thing, this third thing that you hold in common, and that you're kind of surprised there's somebody else who sees it that way. He says with Tolkien, it was their love for Northern mythology. And reading your comic makes me, it was a fresh opportunity to be grateful God had put me in a place where I had a few people in my real life who would look at something like the idea that aliens are demons and not be, that wouldn't recoil from that. And they would say, you know, I've actually thought about that too.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Yeah, it also makes a weird kind of like, I don't know what to call it, almost like coalition of the fringes thing, where even if you don't have one particular thing in common, when I meet people and I can tell they don't have a lot of those mental walls or they're open to things, I'm like, oh, like you just said, like, oh, you too. I met this guy at a party the other night. He grew up like a Jehovah's Witness, and now he's kind of like just floating, you know, agnostic, I guess you could say. But just the fact that he was open to things and we got to talking and it was very openly, even though we don't have the same view, it was like, oh, you're also, you know, open to just looking at weird stuff. So yeah, it's really interesting. It's an interesting thing for sure.
Yeah. I remember I come from a very small rural community, and the nearest public library was, you know, 30 minutes away or whatever. But I remember being like in what we would now call esoterica, like UFO stuff and whatnot, being as probably like middle school in there, like just pulling books off the shelf and reading and whatever. And I'm kind of just always hoping somebody's going to be in the same row of books, like looking at similar stuff. But then also kind of terrified because, like, how do you broach that, you know?
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. So I guess really maybe to kind of peel back on some of the more esoteric stuff. I actually was flabbergasted when I read the Chiquita Banana comic.
yeah.
And a character in that comic has this line. I wrote it down. Yeah. So one of the characters in the comic says, "Lots of entities in fiction are real. Authors and artists puncture into another realm to document them, or the entities use them." And maybe that's one of those obsessive epiphanies that you talked about, because that idea really gripped me as a literature fan, as a literature lover, but also a student of like religious history, because I think mythology works that way. I think there's an entity out there somewhere behind the name Zeus, for instance. And so I'm curious, and you know, you're really going to break my heart if the answer goes the wrong way here, but I got to ask, I mean, is that something you put in to kind of get a laugh out of a guy going through some kind of cognitive breakdown? Or do you think you're on to, I mean, is that an actual proposition that okay, good art connects with something out there that exists objectively?
Yeah. Okay. So it's really funny that you're kind of shown out to you, because there definitely is like a deep lore behind that particular line in the comic, probably maybe like oddly deep, but yeah, well, okay. So it's a few things going on there. One would just be something that's just really interesting and random that used to be sort of floating on the internet, esoterica, and now it's kind of like died off. But I've always been this way into finding the weirdest stuff possible. And online, it used to be a lot more common back in like old Wild West internet days, but now not so much anymore. But you can find these kind of like fringe spiritual groups where people identify maybe with like animals spiritually. Sometimes they're called like otherkin, and they literally feel like they have the spirit of like a wolf or something, or like a bird. Like, I have this kinship with dogs, and like really like I'm a dog inside, but I just look like a human, you know. And they talk to each other. It's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like pagany, but sometimes they think of it that way, sometimes they don't. But that's a thing. And there's all these really weird fractured subgroups in there. Maybe it's just like kids in middle school, or maybe it's really weird adults, like who knows. But there's this one group that I read about a really, really long time ago. And basically their idea was like, just like that, like, you know, you have this kinship with wolves. Maybe you're like a wolf kin or something. But they had that with fictional characters, like of anime or video games or things like that. And that was basically their mechanism for explaining it, that like when someone makes a work of art, that fictional character is actually real in some way. Maybe it's part of like a parallel universe, or maybe in some way it was real. And so when you made, you know, whether it's a novel, or maybe it's something even just fantastic and ridiculous, like Dragon Ball Z or something, you know, that is actually real. And the artist that made that and the person that wrote it punctured in their mind into this sort of other world unknowingly and recorded this story that actually happened. And that explains why I feel this intense spiritual kinship with this fictional character. They're actually real. You know, maybe I was them in like a reincarnation or something. So sort of just generic weird internet stuff. But at the same time, that idea really gripped me. It's one of the first times I was like, wow, I'm really finding some weird stuff online, and I'm so down. And it really never left me, because I thought it was really, really interesting. And it sort of resurfaced in your audience. People are probably the spectrum of 0% to 100% familiar with like general, let's call it like occult and esoterica history. But long story short, at a certain point in Western occult, there becomes this acknowledgement of like, yeah, you know, maybe we're doing like ritual magic and lighting, you know, the red candles and wearing the blue robe on, you know, the first full moon of spring. And maybe there is some, you know, cosmic reason we're doing that, but eventually it sort of tends over to, but also, or primarily, we're doing that to affect our own minds. And you do all this stuff and it affects how you see things. And the general end point or current point of the development of Western like magic, you know, magic like with a K, is sort of more through that lens. That's actually what chaos magic is, if people have heard of chaos magic before. It's just basically kind of the idea of when you do stuff, it affects your view of things, and that's altering reality, isn't it? So that's kind of what magic is, when you do stuff to alter your or other people's views of reality. And it gets pretty interesting, because then like branding becomes sort of a form of esoterica. You know, there's an essay called Pop Magic, which Christian audience, I'll just say, it mentions masturbation in case you're not trying to read about that. But it asks the question of, you know, isn't the Coca-Cola logo kind of like a spiritual thing floating off in the mental landscape? And why does that have more power than something like the Dr. Pepper logo? You know, the Coca-Cola logo has more power. Why is that? And it gets really weird and fuzzy, and you go into this sort of weird place with it. But then you also get to this point where it's like, well, a lot of these modern media characters, they're kind of not really that different than something like a Greek myth in a way. I mean, enough people think about Mickey Mouse and can kind of channel his energy. Like, what does that even mean? You can see someone in a Mickey Mouse suit and say, oh, that guy's really good. He's really acting like Mickey Mouse, you know, but Mickey Mouse isn't real. Like, what does that even mean? So you get into this weird fuzzy space where modern fictional entities and these things that inhabit the modern mental landscape kind of do have like a weird mental spiritual component to them. And that's really what I was kind of driving at there. There's an idea called egregores. Some people might know of it, some people might not, but the idea of an egregore is basically like, it's kind of like a thought form that takes on its own life in a way. And yeah, you get in this weird fuzzy space where it's like, well, Mickey Mouse is a perfect example. He kind of does exist in a way that's not conditional on any one person. It almost is this like living bubble of thought that's floating out there. As for the direct question you asked me, I kind of go either way depending on what it is or maybe even how I feel in that moment. I would say on the one hand, you could kind of pitch it as purely mundane and say, well, yeah, like enough people made Mickey Mouse art and Zeus art, let's say, and it kind of coalesced and became this thing that has a life beyond itself. Or sometimes I could fall on the other side and be like, no, actually, like you just said, there is this entity called Mercury out there, and he like uses people to make sculptures of him, and maybe he used to be more powerful. I think it probably depends. I could fall on either side depending on what it is. But working in art, working in fiction in a way, it is something I've thought about quite a bit. And then it keeps fracturing out into more and more weird subtopics like aesthetics. You know, fictional worlds have their own kind of aesthetic, and that entails like a value system and way of acting and everything. And then that affects people. You know, something like Star Wars has affected people's real life, maybe more so than certain other real things. And does that mean Star Wars is real? I guess in a provisional sense, maybe it's real though. You know, it gets into this whole weird, it gets into a very strange like territory, which I guess I was trying to get at with that comic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, every bit of that's fascinating. I guess people listening to this maybe think like, oh, that's kind of platonic or whatever, but it's as real as my living room. You know, we're as a parent, I'm trying to help my kids have space in an environment dominated by mass media to grow as humans without being shaped by modern advertising. And so like I noticed really early on with my kids, we could watch shows that had ideas that are pretty contrary to our family's values and my understanding as a parent of what objective reality is, and talk about those objectively. And my kids seem to have a good handle on that, but it was the advertising. You know, I had to like pretty quickly figure out, how do I just cut advertising out of our life? Because my kids aren't, they're not human enough yet, or like they're not independent humans enough yet to really know how to handle this stuff, 'cause it's really potent.
Yeah, and so that's also really funny, because it's like that's just a really, really interesting distinction, because it's almost like the fictional stuff, by virtue of being presented as fiction, is in one folder. But if you think about it, ads aren't really presented as fiction. So maybe the kids take it as like face value. And then that sort of falls back in everything we were just saying, because then the difference is just how it's being presented. It's just the act of the presenter, basically.
Sure. Well, I guess I am going to make everything about C.S. Lewis here, but you know, when he was converted, he went from maybe an agnostic, but he saw the similarities between different mythologies produced by different groups of people, and kind of thought that meant they were all junk. They're all kind of drawing on basic human desires. They're escalated up to divinity status. It, you know, it's rooted basically in what do men want to be, and they make the divinity out of it. But Tolkien and a friend named Owen Barfield came along and said, no, Christianity is the true mythology. Every time you've seen a god die and rise, it's because it's an echo of what's actually true. And so that seems to square up quite a bit with that Chiquita comic. And I already know that it works the other way, because like Aslan helps me love Christ more, helps me imagine Christ more authentically and be captivated by him more. So maybe it goes the other way. Like Aslan is reflection of Christ. Maybe Atticus Finch is a reflection of some, you know, some higher intelligence somewhere that, you know, that Harper Lee punched into and made a connection with, some kind of, I don't know, avatar of justice or something.
Yeah, that's super interesting, man. Yeah, C.S. Lewis is definitely an interesting case study because the fiction is like an illuminator, from what I understand, right? Like you're saying, there's a guy named Eliphas Levy. He was like a hardcore occultist. It's actually, it would be an interesting case because he was like the occult guy at a certain time and place. Actually, if anyone's seen like that drawing of Baphomet, he like drew that drawing. But then later he became Christian. He actually became like Catholic near the end of his life. And he has this quote, which is, imagination is not the creator of illusion, but the illuminator of reality. Hmm. And I think that that's like something really interesting. I used to be kind of like down on fiction in a way, but oddly, even though I didn't really encounter his work very hardcore, Tolkien also had a little story where he really flipped my view on it. And he was basically saying, you know, like, you're thinking of fiction as this, you know, mirage, like it's like it's fake, you know, it's not real, right? But he was like, you know, if we were two people locked in prison, we might not sit and talk about the prison. We might talk about other stuff, like where we're from or spiritual things, or, you know, and that wouldn't make it not real because we're sitting in a prison, right? We're talking about things that are almost more real than this like cage that we're locked in. And that really like flipped my perspective on it quite a bit. I don't really consider myself a writer, but obviously it's tangentially related to what I do. So yeah, man, that's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the bow. But did you say the name was Eliphas Levy?
Yeah, it's like Eliphas, and then his last name is Levy, Levi. He's like a pretty hardcore occult guy, but like right near the end of his life, he became Catholic. And then he has a quote, like just kind of like what we were saying, like, you know, all these occultists talk about, you know, having talismans and amulets, but like we have the cross. So they all talk about this other thing and we have this thing that's like the real version of it, you know? So that perspective is something that comes up in a few like weird places for sure.
I wish we were having this conversation after you finish reading the Chronicles of Narnia with your kid. You've got much on this ahead of you, friend.
Yeah.
That I cool. think you could find interesting. But Lewis wrote a ton of letters to kids. He had an incredible correspondence. And one time this little girl wrote him and said, hey, I think I love Aslan more than Christ. And she was really distressed. And Lewis, I just thought it was such a great answer. He wrote back and said, look, everything you like about Aslan is better found in Christ. And so you really love Christ. You just, you know, the line is in your imagination right now. And I really appreciated that answer. I think it gets at something that may be truer in a broader sense.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. So on, you know, moving from that, I had a friend who asked me, he said, you know, Owen talks about having read widely in the arcane and the occult, and clearly you have a real expertise on imagery and symbolism and things like that. I hope this connects. Is there, you know, other than your collection here, this book we're talking about, is there anything you would point someone to say, hey, if you really want to start giving yourself an education on symbolism, maybe even iconography, I'm not sure how much you know, relate to that. It's not part of my faith tradition, but I know there's overlap on the Venn diagram. Is there anything that you would point to and say, like, man, that was really interesting and helped me think about how to use symbols in my own work?
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah. Well, there's a few things coming to mind. There's a few different pockets, I would say, when people ask me, like, oh, I'm interested in symbolism. One of them is the Jungian, like Carl Jung pocket. I'm really not a Carl Jung guy, not for any particular reason. I just, you know, it's not really my world, you could say. But I think there's one book that I think is a really, really good starting place. I'm sure people would benefit from reading a lot of his books, but there's one book that I think is a really good starting place. And it's called The Book of Symbols. And it's actually not by him. It's published by this group called Tashin. They make a lot of art books. But if you search for Book of Symbols, there's a big hand on the front. Tashin is like T-A-S-C-H-E-N or something. It's pretty big. It was actually published by a group that specializes in Jungian symbolism research. So it's not by one person. But I think if someone really doesn't have like a foot in that world, that's a really good book because it's almost like an encyclopedia and you open it and it goes, you know, here's deer. Well, what does a deer represent? Well, deers are kind of like this. And here's how a deer was used in art. And it's super easy to read. Each entry is just one page and has a lot of pictures. And I think that even more so than just the information that you're getting from it, which is really good, I do return to it quite often, it gives you a really good idea of the lens of like, oh, well, a deer is, you know, fleet-footed, it's very swift, and it runs towards the water. Oh, that kind of makes sense. Like Augustine used the deer as like, you know, runs and runs and runs to get to the water. It's like a spiritual seeker. But also maybe, you know, in Japan, deers came out in the full moon. So it kind of gives you this lens of like, oh, here's how these things kind of start to mean and point to other things in a way that's drawing from all history and religions and things like that. In the esoterica domain, you know, I will mention it here. I kind of stopped mentioning it on Twitter because I don't ever want to be responsible for like misleading anyone. You know, when I get to I always joke with my wife, but like when I get to like Judgment Day, you know, I'm going to have enough to answer for. I don't want to have to answer for like misleading, you know, some guy down some weird path. But there's a book called Three Books of Occult Philosophy, and it's by this guy named Agrippa. And there's a version edited by Donald Tyson. The thing is, you know, I'm Christian also, obviously. So it comes with like a big caveat sticker of like, yeah, it really is a book like about occult stuff. But the cool thing about that book is that he also is Christian or became Christian also, just for the record. But I mean, it is like a book about like magic and like, you know, occult stuff, basically. So just saying. Anyway, the point is that the book itself was published in the 1530s. And if you had just the book Agrippa published, it's very small. I mean, you could see it sitting on a shelf. It's like really tiny. But Donald Tyson, who, by the way, just again, given all the caveats, he's like a hardcore like magic occult guy, went through and footnoted everything in the book. So the book is like 1,000+ pages. And it's a pretty awesome resource if you don't feel like you'd be tempted towards, you know, the dark arts, let's say, because it goes through and it says, you know, here's the chapter on fire and air in terms of the four elements. And when Agrippa says, you know, Plato says this about fire and this about air, there's a footnote. And then in the footnotes, Donald Tyson has that exact quote of what Plato said about those elements. So it's a really epic resource. And I've gotten a lot out of it because you can go in and say, you know, well, I can go to the chapter on the planets. And it's like, well, here's this thing about the planets. I can go to the footnotes and it says, here's what Pliny the Elder said about the planets, and it's in this book, and I can Google that book, and it's for free because it's online. So it's really like an epic compendium that I've gotten quite a bit out of. I read it really voraciously back when I was in sort of magic world, but surprisingly, I have turned to it for that reason, to say, oh, wait, you know, he mentioned that thing about Virgil. Virgil had some prophecy of like a lamb coming and like washing the world clean of its blood. That's kind of interesting. Where was that? Or things about divination in antiquity. I guess it's sort of relevant, but as a Christian person, I do feel like initially, I had a lot of conflict in terms of I'm really into esoterica and weird stuff, but now I see that there's a bad aspect of it. Initially, I had a really big internal conflict with that, and I kind of tried to make it work for a while, and I wasn't really sure what to do. But I kind of did come to terms with it, and that I am like an esotericist, and I'm into symbolism and things like that. So I feel like as long as you're not doing anything weird and bad, it's okay. But I guess, you know, some people could be sucked into certain things. So you can tell them a little bit like, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's like, go get like the black magic book. It's not really what it is, but, you know, so that book's really, really interesting. It's called Three Books of Occult Philosophy by Donald Tyson. I usually describe it as like a snapshot of Western esoterica right around 1500. And he's in Germany. It's kind of like a college course. I recommended it to one person. They were like, this was too hard for me to read. So I'm just mentioning that. Anyway, on the more smaller side, and then on the Christian symbolism side, you know, it gets a little difficult. One of the best books is a book called Signs and Symbols in Christian Art. I think the guy that wrote it, his last name is Ferguson. It's a really, really great book. It's really about Renaissance art symbolism, not what the title claims it to be, which is Christian symbolism. But I really like that book because I think the Renaissance set of symbolism, it's almost like a crystallization and total all-encompassing little self-contained world. And I think going in that and fleshing it out and then looking at the art really also gives you like a view into how symbols are and how they function. Those would be like the main big three. Aside from that, of course, there's like a million other interesting books, but at a certain point you kind of start doing your own research and just going down weird little roads yourself or investigating, you know, biblical symbols and typology and things like that. But one of those three would probably be a good place for people to start depending on where they're at right now.
That is excellent. I really appreciate you giving us that. Listeners, I'm going to put links to Owen's Twitter and where to buy his book, but I'll try to track some of those things down too. I appreciate the caution you're showing by, like, I don't want to put people on a dark spiritual path, but it also makes sense of, like, you're talking about these guys who were occultists who then ended up in the faith. I don't know if you're aware of Scott Derrickson. He did the Doctor Strange movies for Marvel, but he made a movie called The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And the interviews he did leading up to that is some of the best stuff on, like, Christians making art I've ever read. And one of the points he made is that he made that book to say this stuff all hangs in somebody's system, and we should tease that out. So, like, if you're someone who believes in demons, well, what else is in that ecosystem? And if you ask that question, it's not really it's really easy to get to, oh, the Christian God, you know. So I think those things can be encountered, just my own opinion. I think they can be encountered without, like, destroying your faith or mind or, you know, whatever. Because
it, no, definitely. Yeah.
If you have a framework they hang in, then they have a place, right? They belong somewhere.
Yeah, there's a certain archetype of person I think that I really embody where it's like, you know, like we were talking about before, if someone said, hey, don't go look under those rocks, I mean, I'm going to do it, obviously. So I feel like where I'm at, it's kind of better for me to say, you know, hey, if you are that kind of person, yeah, like, this is probably the rock to look under. And frankly, what you're going to find is not, like, a cohesive spiritual system. You'll find some cool, interesting shards. But like you said, most of the cool stuff is going to be cribbed from the Christian system anyway. I mean, back when I was even into that stuff, I was really obsessed with, like, hierarchies of angels and things like that. And it wasn't until someone said what you just told me, they were like, well, how does this fit into a systemic framework? I mean, if angels are real, like, dot, dot, dot. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, I guess the dot, dot, dot leads me, you know, somewhere else.
Yeah. So that's another one of my favorite comics in the book. It's these two characters who I think one of them is holding a flashlight labeled Esoterica. And another says, oh, what you really need is this battery, and it's labeled Christianity. And when you stick it in, the light comes on. Man, that was another, like, man, get out of my head moment, because I'm the person you're talking about who always wants to dig in and see and flip the rock over, which, as a sidebar, I'd love to know if you think that's intrinsic to people, or if that's like a nurture versus nature kind of thing. But the epiphany that comic captures was really important to me. I was having dinner with a guy one time who said, do you really believe a snake talked? Talking about the garden. And I was sitting there eating, like, some pretzel, and I said, well, I believe a guy rose from the dead. And so if that's on the table, what else? I mean, what else am I going to look at and be like, nah, that's too crazy, you know?
No, totally. Yeah. Yeah, a few people mentioned that comic to me. I guess it kind of struck a chord with some people for sure. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that really was like a big kind of like epiphany moment for me. I mean, it's kind of like what we were just talking about, but it's like I collected all these shards and you get some cool stuff. You're like, oh, you know, the four elements, like in the zodiac, and how does the four elements fit with the zodiac, and how does it fit with the planets? But like, eventually it's kind of like you're tinkering in this basement and you're kind of just collecting like random wires and like putting them together. You know, you don't have like the book about how electricity really works, let's say. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really did have like I didn't used to be Christian, obviously. I really did have like a sort of like conversion moment, and then I started going back to like see everything differently. But yeah, I really felt like that comic, just that analogy perfectly says it. You know, it's almost like, you know, I can't think of a better analogy than that, so I drew it that way. But it's like you have the shell, and then all of a sudden the shell is like filled out and you're seeing the shell totally differently.
Well, I appreciate the way it kind of gives encouragement too. I mean, I grew up in, I guess, probably what mainstream culture would see as religious fundamentalism, if I can say it, fundamentalism. But I never was in that deal where, like, you can't ask questions, stay away from, you know, the darker sides of human exploration, any of that. But I do run into a lot of people that are like, man, am I bad for having an interest in this? Is this, you know, I don't know, does this show some kind of spiritual defect? And I want to say, like, I think you're just interested in seeing how God made his world. You know, not always. Like, some guys have dark interests that I don't think are profitable, but a lot of times it's just people who want to know what are all the contours of God's creation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, also actually on that note, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because maybe other people listening will be like in that boat. I'm from the total opposite world where basically everyone's kind of like an atheist or they're like spiritual but not religious, and everything's on the table except biblical Christianity. You know, I've mentioned it like one panel in the book, kind of, not really actually, but you know, in my world, it was like, oh, what are you reading? A book about Mongolian shamanism. Oh, what are you doing? I'm going to this Tibetan Buddhist thing. Oh, what are you doing? I'm reading a book about demons. And then it's like, oh, what are you reading? Like, oh, I'm reading this Christian thing. And people are like, wait, what? And yeah, that's the thing that like sings out as odd. That really is how it is, by the way. So yeah, one thing I think I can offer people, or that is really important to me, and I kind of tabled this part of my project, but I do come back to it often, is that for people that are Christian, I mean, I can say especially in America, maybe it's the same everywhere, but like, I think that, not to speak beyond my rank, but we've kind of gotten, I'm also late to the party, but we've kind of gotten along with like being able to not address certain things that are coming in as spiritual influences. Like when I look back at the 50s and even the 60s, even the 80s or 90s, man, like even something like Buddhism, I mean, it wasn't really here in the same way that it is now. Maybe if you were really into it, you could find like a book somewhere. But like now, dude, like we have to address these things like head on. So just kind of like, I mean, it's not for every person. I'm not saying everyone has to go out and learn about like ayahuasca and DMT and Tibetan Buddhism. But if you're the kind of person who's like, I'm Christian and I'm really curious about this, that could be used as a positive thing, because we are not equipped in general as a large group to be doing what we need to do on the front lines of, here's this like 19-year-old who is like, well, Buddhism seems like it's totally correct about stuff. Like, why is it bad? I think 99% of Christians, no fault of their own, I mean, we live in America, aren't equipped to be like, well, here's actually like the theological defects in that system from my point of view. And like, here's the questions that doesn't answer. And here's why, you know, I think most people are not equipped for that. So if you are drawn to those things, it's probably a good thing. In my opinion, we need more people who are able to be like, actually, here's why I think this thing is not true from where I'm sitting, rather than just, yeah, I have no idea, I've never looked at it, which is fine for, you know, maybe 99% of people. They're not going to investigate some weird spiritual system. That's fine. But I think that that can definitely be a positive thing. And I think we need more of it from where I'm sitting, for sure.
Full and complete agreement. One of my favorite comics that I laughed the hardest at was, you've got one where Joe Rogan meets the exalted Alex Jones, and, yeah, you know, and they're talking about DMT and stuff. And I mean, on the vein you were just talking in, as we become more materialist and more poly-religious as a society, I hear these guys talking about DMT. They, you know, DMT and ayahuasca is their aggressive epiphany, and they sound like they've had a religious conversion, and they talk about meeting these intelligences when they're on ayahuasca. And I'm like, dude, that doesn't surprise me at all. It doesn't surprise me at all. I just think I know they're demons and you don't. And so like, you're walking in thinking these are exalted masters from a higher plane of existence are going to lead you to utopia. And I'm like, no, they're going to eat you. They're going to eat your soul. You know? Yeah, I think totally. That's a real danger.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I was really in that world for a long time. And I feel like as I put certain pieces together, just in terms of like, you know, progress of Christendom and like where we're at and where certain things are breaking on, let's say, like the front lines, that was like a really odd piece of the puzzle. I mean, some people listening probably don't know, but like, it's only recently that things like DMT and ayahuasca, which, again, in case people don't know, are really like 9 or 10 exponential steps beyond other quote unquote normal psychedelics. It's really only very recently that they are breaking in the culture. I mean, when I used to listen to tapes, even from like the 90s or early 2000s, I mean, it was pretty hard to find. It wasn't that long ago that you had to literally like go to the Amazon to do ayahuasca. And recently I was driving through, you know, some Midwestern state, and there was like an ayahuasca group there, like doing ayahuasca, you know? So I think the ramifications of that are really just breaking. And again, it's another reason why, if you're that kind of person, we need more people equipped to address that, because it's happening. And like, the dial's not going to turn back anytime soon. In fact, it's only going to become more normalized and more popular. And like you said, it really, like, people have like a very powerful experience, and then they're looking for answers about it.
Yeah, I'll tell you just a story from my own life about this. I was preaching through the book of Ephesians, and when Paul gets to a vice list at the end, he talks about witchcraft. Well, the Greek word behind it is pharmakeia, which is where we get the, you know, the term pharmaceuticals from. And so I just mentioned this from the pulpit as like, hey, we're getting ready to talk about this in the coming weeks, and mentioned ayahuasca and some of this stuff. Well, so I have certain convictions about technology in the church and whatnot. And so like at that point, we weren't streaming our services or releasing them electronically or anything. But a guy emailed me that I don't know him, never saw his name before. He sent it to my personal address. It's not anything that's public knowledge. And he said, hey, when are you going to preach on that? I really want to come visit because my nephew is getting eaten up by this stuff. And I told him, you know, and as far as I know, he wasn't there that Sunday, but I don't think that was any like, you know, I don't think that was some supernatural thing other than I think people are like really hungry for the church to speak to this. And we have really good resources to do so, but we just haven't been in that space. And we need people to, I mean, particularly in an age where there's so many evangelists for ayahuasca and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. It's also kind of hard because you almost need someone, not to be like me, but you kind of do need someone who was like in that world and then left it. And it's pretty rare, relatively. Of course, it happens, you know, with some frequency, thankfully. But I think there's a certain point where once you go deep enough into it, you don't really leave it again. So, you know, naturally, most people who have invested their time more positively, like yourself, studying scripture and things like that, haven't taken a detour, you know, to go do ayahuasca for like 5 years or something. Yeah. So it's a weird situation. But I do think about that a lot. I was pretty in that world for a while. I think about the people that I met there and things like that. It comes into my mind sometimes for sure.
Well, I know you're on Jonathan Peugeot's podcast. Do you keep up with what he's up to?
Yeah, I do sometimes. Actually, it's really funny. He's someone whose work I really admire, and I think he's like killing it. It's almost like for that reason, I try and stay a few months behind on what he's doing because I don't want to watch one of his videos and then have it influence what I'm doing, and then we're both doing the same thing at the same time.
Sure.
But yeah, he's a really cool, interesting guy.
Well, he's working on this comic about St. Christopher, this dog-headed saint.
Oh, yeah.
And he, you know, Peugeot's made this point that like that's a monster who carried Christ across the waters of chaos, you know, and that we kind of need monsters to help bridge that gap between the world of monsters and the church. And I'm not Eastern Orthodox by any stretch, but, you know, you kind of like, well, I'm kind of envious. Y'all have St. Christopher. <You know?
laughs> Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, man. For a while, I actually just an interesting, like odd tangential note. But for a while, I was having these dreams. I usually don't dream. Actually, it's kind of interesting just in terms of the comics and my like creative life. But back in that time when I was like, you know, smoking weed a lot and drinking a lot, I probably didn't have any regular dreams for like 10 plus years. Like I just, dreaming was like not a thing for me.
Huh.
Then when I moved out here and I stopped smoking weed literally all the time, I started having some dreams, but I started having this set of dreams that felt like really, really, really significant. And they all revolved around like poisonous animals and snakes and like venomous animals. And they involved like some of the people I was doing ayahuasca with, and they all had this kind of overarching theme of like me like handling these snakes and poisonous animals and like putting them in tanks so other people could see them and know like to avoid them. It was really crazy. And then they stopped like super abruptly. I had one final one where this like, you know, holy person was like, sort of like a monk, was telling me like, yeah, you have to put the poisonous animals in the tank so the kids can see them and they'll see them safely, but they might bite you. But, you know, we think you're a really good person to do it. And I woke up and I was like, wow, it's a little on the nose, don't you think? And then they just stopped after that abruptly. So it's kind of weird. I feel like that maybe is like part of my path. But yeah, I think about that a lot, actually. Yeah.
Okay, so then I'm going to have to circle back. You know, we talked about the Chiquita banana thing and puncturing through to some of the kind of reality with art. I mean, if you had to pick, do dreams do that? Do dreams push us into some kind of contact with, I don't know if higher or other is the right word, but other realms of existence and truth and whatnot?
Yeah, I'm oddly in this position where I'm constantly on Twitter or on my online sphere like, hey, I'm not an expert. I'm really just an artist. You know, I just do this thing. But people often ask me very personal questions in my messages. And I often get people asking me what I think about dreams or I had this dream, you know. I think it goes in a few directions. I think sometimes there are like purely mundane dreams. Like sometimes someone will contact me and be like, oh my God, I had this dream. Like I killed this guy. And sometimes I'm like, okay, sometimes it really is just random. Like sometimes it doesn't mean anything. I guess that's obvious. I think that, well, in the Bible, you know, God speaks to people through dreams, right? That definitely happens. For me personally, I had some dreams that were like very symbolically significant. I had some dreams that were in another folder where whenever there was any kind of biblical symbolism, I woke up like, okay, that kind of feels significant in some way. I do feel like I've gotten some messages in my dreams or spiritual information, not like in a weird psychic way, but like, you know, I'll have a dream of a memory of something bad that I did like 10 years ago. And I'm like, wow, I used to be like that kind of person. And now I'm this kind of person. And it'll like facilitate my spiritual growth. As for like actual entities and realms and things like that, I mean, it's kind of like the drug thing also. It's not off the table for me for sure. I don't think it's every time. I'm very, again, with the caution, I'm very cautious of being like, yeah, that's totally 100% real. I think it definitely informs, it definitely is like a percent of the pie chart, but I couldn't say how much. I couldn't say how much. I've had a few dreams also where people are like, someone's asking me very like pointed questions. And when you wake up, you really feel like you were talking to someone, which could be an illusion, but yeah, I definitely think dreams intersect with the spiritual for sure. But what percentage of the cases that is, it would be difficult for me to like pin down.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Well, thinking, you know, about the book some more, if I had facility with, you know, artistry, I'd probably be asking you if I could license your idea to have ghosts interacting with people as like ideological guides. yeah. That's one of my favorite sections, and I can't remember who you have go to the grocery store with a guy and like have him talk about advertising, but I thought that was great.
Yeah.
I cackled though at the Luther and Calvin one, so I'm a Reformed Baptist. Those guys are big in my intellectual library, you know. But the one that I thought was just great was you know, Luther being like, look, we nailed stuff to doors. That's how we did stuff. But the payoff was, but I also really like doing that.
Yeah,
I thought that
was true. Yeah, man, I really liked that little subsection. I did a bunch of those around my wedding, so they kind of have like a nice, also just like nostalgic feel for me. But yeah, it's cool you responded to the format of, you know, hanging out with like ghosts that like are these people that represent sort of their own like ideology and worldview. I think a lot of guys could probably relate to that if they're sort of our archetype maybe. I do want to return to that or maybe weave it into the comics I'm doing now because it really does kind of feel that way. You know, right now I'm reading this book. It's called The Great Controversy by Ellen White. She was like a Seventh-day Adventist. And I'm reading it as part of this like larger research thing I'm doing. But it kind of feels like I'm hanging out with her. You know what I mean? I go to the store and I pass a church and I remember something she said about the in the book and I'm like, oh yeah, you know. And I think it's a really interesting personification of that effect. You know, if you're reading a lot of John Calvin, it's kind of like you're hanging out with him, kind of, you know. And you know, you see something on your way to work and you're like, oh, I know, I kind of feel like I know what John Calvin might say about that, or you know, maybe he would say this, you know. So yeah, that personification I thought was really fun.
Oh, and it's, I mean, it's such a great, I mean, I don't think that art has to be pedagogical, you know, or instructive necessarily, but it's a great way to like help people enjoy getting to think through how ideas impact us, right? Ideas have consequences. And I just thought, man, that's really brilliant. And it was a fun trip too. So, I mean, yeah, do more of that, man. Do more of that.
Yeah. It's also this weird, funny thing. I don't think I've ever like talked about this particular aspect of it with things with anyone, but there's this really weird area that I've stumbled across in life where it's almost like one of the best ways to learn about something is like making jokes about it, because to make a joke about something requires like a deeper knowledge of how it functions on like a deeper level. And I almost feel like there's just something there that I could dig into a little bit further. Like if I'm talking with someone, which very rarely happens, but like if John Calvin comes up in my mind, I know what he thought about certain things because I made certain comics about it. So it's lodged in my mind like, oh yeah, John Calvin thought that infant baptism was good because I made that comic about it. I remember researching it. And I remember that. And it's like locked in my mind. I hope I got that right. I think I did. But anyway, things like that. It's almost like to joke about something requires a deeper knowledge of it. So it's weird. It's almost like you could teach kids stuff by having them like joke about it. I don't know. There's something going on there that maybe I'll figure out eventually.
Well, I mean, related to that, one of the most profound things I've read this year came out of your book, where you talked about the danger of saying I'm doing something just as a joke. You know, that it kind of gives a beachhead, or a, I don't know, gives you like some kind of authorization to explore something that you wouldn't otherwise do. So, I mean, I think that making a joke is useful and consequential in a couple different ways.
Yeah, I think Wittgenstein, this philosopher, said that you could write a whole philosophical worldview just using jokes, which I think is really true. But yeah, I mean, that's also kind of how I got here. You know, you asked me about like the persona and everything. Like, yeah, there's something about giving yourself the license to say like, yeah, you know, I'm kind of just messing around with this, that can make it more real. I had a really weird realization with my art eventually, because, you know, I was really working hard on my art and getting better at it, which I have for most of my life. But I had this weird moment in my apartment where I realized that every time I made the best stuff, I sat down at my desk and thought, you know, I'll just kind of do something for fun right now. And that those were all the best things. And it was this really weird moment of like, maybe I shouldn't like think too deeply about this, because maybe I'll mess it up and ruin the whole system I have going. But yeah, it's weird. You know, the creative process and how it works is also a big part of what I do.
Well, that, I mean, that's one question I've got on my sheet here of stuff I, you know, if we got to it, I wanted to ask. Your comics are very funny often, but they're not always funny. I mean, I know you talked about how like the daily comic strip format became a burden and a wall because you had to end on a joke, basically. But I mean, do you think explicitly through, I'm sitting down to write something funny? Or do you sit down to write, and if something funny comes out, that's just part of the mix? I was just curious how you creatively navigate that.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. Well, with it's kind of like a deeper question in a way, because I realized along the way that my relationship to time in art is extremely conditional on the fact that I am an image maker and that I make still images. In my mind, I'm kind of like a painter, but I don't really paint much anymore. And that's manifested in a few ways. I have a really weird relationship to movies. I almost like don't get movies as an art form. I don't have like a problem with them, but there's something about like it's an image, but it's moving, and I'm like a painter. I make still images. It just kind of like something doesn't sit in my brain right, I guess, which makes me weird. But it relates to writing, because I really can't sit down and make pieces move through time. When I tried to do more writing a long time ago, I realized that I was just describing scenes and images in my writing. Like, I would sit down and say, you know, there's this guy and he's, you know, he has these ideas in his head and he does this thing for his job and he's sitting here at this desk, you know, and he's got this stuff on his wall, and I'm looking at the paper and I'm like, okay, like do something, like move, like do, like, you know, and then what do I write? Like, he gets up and goes to the fridge, you know. It's like making the pieces move isn't how my brain works. Which is interesting, because I make still images, so there, it's always a photograph of like an instant.
Sure.
So with the writing, I basically, it's almost like I don't really even write them. I just see the clear arc all the way through, and I'm like, yeah, there's a comic, we're good to go, and I put it down on paper as fast as I can. So people ask me about the writing process, but it's almost like I have no process. It's like I can't fake it. Like right now, if you said, you know, sit down and write an 8-page comic, I would really need to have the idea, and the idea comes in toto. It's not built from the ground up. Like, I have this comic that I haven't released yet. It's the exclusive take. But I have this comic where these guys get really into like Neoplatonism, and they bring down like the archetypal chair into their house, and they start messing with the chair, and it like affects all the chairs around them. And like that idea, it's not like I sat down and I was like, okay, time to make a comic about Neoplatonism. Okay, what would be funny? I was like literally in the shower and I saw what the beginning, middle, and end would be. And I was like, boom, that's it. So on that note of what you actually asked me about, it's not really intentional. Sometimes it's a joke that is the end point. Sometimes there's like a idea and how it manifested is the end point, but it's not really so intentional. I'm engaging with that in a weird way now, because I kind of did lock into a Sunday comic strip format for the series I'm working on now, which is mostly about me like having a baby and a dog and like living out here. But yeah, it's, to more directly answer it, I think it's usually the comics are funny, because that's the standard format. And every now and then it's like I untie my boat from that anchor and just kind of let myself drift further away and see what would happen. There's a comic in there called Fishmans, Fishman's Fishman. Fishman's is a band from Japan, in case anyone's interested. But Fishman is the comic. And that's a good example, because it's like I untied myself from that anchor and said, you know, okay, what would happen if I, you know, got a little creepy? What would that be like if I drifted towards Creepy Island? The sex comic kind of happened that way, too. I untied my anchor from the funny spot and said, you know, what if I just talked about this thing really openly? So a lot of the not funny ones are more like experiments that then turn out successful, if that makes sense. But yeah, the writing and intentionality is hard to like pin down.
Well, that Fishman one, I kind of had it under the heading of what I think you called an Edigore. I thought of the Jewish golem, of the idea that kind of comes to life and, and goes. But it sounds to me like you're saying like the muse sets upon you, right? I mean, is that fair to say that the spirit of inspiration comes on you and you release it whole cloth and wait, you know, see what the next thing that comes along is?
Kind of, yeah. Honestly, I really do feel that way. Any idea that I get, it really is like, I mean, delivered to me makes it sound like it's explicitly a muse. Maybe it is, but I guess you could say neutrally, it comes up in totality. It comes up, boom, as a cohesive unit. It's never like I build it up from the sum of its parts. And sometimes when I see other artists' work, it's super interesting for me because they do build it up from the sum of its parts. But whenever I do that, I kind of just feel like I'm faking it, or that it doesn't really add up in the way that I thought it would. There's something about it. It's like I kind of need something there to like jump off of, I guess you could say. And yeah, I mean, honestly, I never really say this because it makes me sound like I think my studio is being divinely guided or something. But I often joke that like there is some low ranking angel who maybe like, you know, spilled coffee or something, and this is their job. They're assigned to like overwatch my little operation. But it really does feel that way. It's like, you know, it's been years. It's been a really long time doing art. It's been years doing this in particular. And there really hasn't been a time where I haven't known what to do or had no ideas or anything like that. I suffer from the opposite. There's like a huge pile of papers and there's just, you know, so many ideas, and I have to struggle to pick one and plant it and grow it.
Well, that sounds like the angel with the coffee. It sounds like that would make a decent comic for what it's worth.
Yeah, I should do that. Maybe I will do that, actually, yeah.
I had a student, I teach at a classical school a little bit, and I had a student who came to me kind of on the same track of what we talked about earlier about, like, well, pagan gods may be what Christians call demons. And, you know, like, all the great works of literature from Greco-Roman world appeal to the muse to come inspire them. And she's like, man, is that something we should account as a spiritual danger? And I said, well, you know, Dante did the same thing. I think it just matters which muse you're calling upon, basically. You know, I think the muse can be very helpful in really profitable ways. I mean, as one of your readers, it's working, man. Hang with it.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Well, you've been super generous. I've got really two things to maybe start landing the plane with, and really they're kind of just curiosities, if you'd indulge me.
Yeah, for sure.
With the Calvin and Luther comics and the ghosts and whatnot, you've clearly read, and I'm in the Reformed tradition, so you've clearly read Reformed theology. And I read your thread as of this recording, I think like it's a day old, but we were talking about your current theological questions. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, oh, the Reformed tradition has so many good resources. And I'm sure you get that from a ton of people. But what Reformed theology have you read? Obviously, you've read some of the primary sources, but what beyond that?
Okay, it's interesting because so someone could definitely imagine being me, and since I was, you know, probably like 18 or so, I've pretty much only read exclusively religious texts. Something like clicked on when I was 18 and I was like, wow, I really got to read all this stuff. So I had this mission to read like a religious text from like every religion, and then eventually I got into occult and esoterica world. I was Buddhist for a while, then I became Christian. So it kind of put me in the really odd position of like, wow, I know so much about these other religions. And now I'm like in this camp where there's so much for me to figure out at like a really rapid pace, and I really don't even know where to start. So usually the way I've been doing it, which just happened naturally, but I think it really works for me, is I've been doing it historically. So I'll kind of zoom in on like a historical instance or time period or conflict or something, and then work my way forwards and backwards from there. So I started with, you know, it could be anything. Like I started with kind of the early church. I guess that kind of makes sense. for a while, the anchor was like the papacy, just because it's a good like narrative through time.
Sure.
I hit the Orthodox Catholic schism for a while. That was a good narrative through time. And then I hit the Reformation stuff. Mostly I have a lot of books upstairs that just have really generic titles. I'm actually looking at one right now. It's just called A History of Christianity, Readings in the History of the Church. So mostly I have these books that have like collections of primary sources where it'll just be like chunks of things people wrote. And then I'll listen to whatever like university lectures I can find and things like that. Within the Reform tradition, mostly I kind of just did the 101 history of the Reformation as much as I could, starting with Luther. I got up to about the English situation. I feel like in my mind, I got up to like where the pilgrims are about to leave. And I was like, okay, hold on. And then I kind of rewinded and started to flesh out the pieces more. So I have a book or two about Luther and Calvin upstairs. I haven't hit their primary stuff as much as I would like, but that was kind of the world I was hanging out in for a while. And you could say, I guess to really answer your question, it was always more like the history, and then I'm jumping into the ideas rather than going through their literature piece by piece, which would probably be better, and I will do eventually. But for me, anchoring it in history is a really easy way to stay on track and see how one thing leads to another, which really suits how my brain works, you could say.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense to me. Well, on that front, you know, I know this is why you came on, and you probably have a ton of resources in this front, but if you ever want somebody to send you some good books on some of those questions, you let me know, okay?
Yeah, I do. No, I'm definitely down. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I came into Christianity, and of course the first thing is people are like, oh, you know, you're going to be Catholic or Orthodox or Baptist or what?
Sure.
And I kind of tabled that question for a while. I said, you know, at that time especially, I was like, my life's a mess, man. I'm not trying to figure out stuff like that right now. And I kind of said I was focusing on my relationship with God before I figured that whole thing out. But then I got to the point where I was like, you know, I'm getting different answers from different groups. That's super interesting. And I feel like I padded out a lot of the Catholic and Orthodox view of things. And now it's funny. I'll just be totally honest. At first I was like, man, I really don't get the Protestant situation. Like, it's kind of like, I kind of viewed it through like the lens of like, what? So after like 1,500 years, like some guys just like started figuring it out. Like, that makes no sense. And I kind of just tabled it. But I feel like now that I've worked my way up through the narrative, whether or not I like identify with it, I'm like, oh, now I actually see like where these guys are coming from, and I actually understand it like beyond a caricature, which is super interesting. And yeah, right now, it's not exactly what you asked me, but maybe it's interesting. I'm really going into the American Christian stuff, and I'm trying to figure out where to start and where to land. And it's really interesting because I feel like I'm understanding the perspective, like I said, beyond the caricature of it, which I also did with other groups. But now I'm like, oh, like now I see why that guy felt this way and why it like makes sense in terms of a larger picture. So it's a pretty interesting, exciting time over here intellectually, honestly. Perfect time for me to get books because I just had a baby. So I'm buying a ton of books and I'm like, I'm never going to read this. But but yeah, it's really interesting, and it's kind of exciting, honestly. It's cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, it gets buck wild in the American religious because individualism takes it everywhere, you know. Mormonism over here, westward expansion, and like Sawdust Trail revivalism over there. I mean, that's going to be a fun read.
Yeah, I've kind of been starting at the fringes and like working my way back, which is, I guess, kind of suits my, that's why I mentioned like Seventh-day Adventism before, and I hit the Mormon stuff, and then I'm kind of like working my way backwards. So yeah, man, it's really interesting for sure.
Well, as a Baptist, I'm very much subject to that. Oh, so you guys figured it out, you know, 1800 years in or whatever, which, yeah, I mean, you just got to own it, I guess. But I know with Calvin, it was really important to Calvin to say, actually, we are the apostolic church. The deviation didn't happen with us. We, you know, so those guys were self-conscious about some of the stuff you're picking up on there.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, On the Pageot podcast, I didn't get all of it listened to, but I heard you say that like you're not really, it was like a daunting idea to be like, I've got to figure out the right church and land somewhere. You know, Lewis in Mere Christianity says that there's this hallway that connects all the Christian traditions, and it gives it weight and gravity, and it says this is the same thing. Like, this door opens onto, you know, Presbyterianism, and that door opens onto, say, Eastern Orthodoxy, but it's the hallway that unites them that he's talking about when he says mere Christianity. But he also says you can't live in a hallway. You got to find a room, and that's where you'll live. And so I'm just curious, and feel free to be like, I don't really want to get into that. But any closer to finding a room off the hallway to live in?
Yeah, I used to talk about it a lot. I mean, I have no problem talking about it. Honestly, I like, obviously it's a huge part of my like vibe is just going into these different things in general. I used to talk about it a lot, but then I kind of started to feel like there was an element when if I'm posting about it a lot, that's like kind of like ego aggrandizement where I'm like, oh, who am I going to pick? Who am I going to, you know, what team am I going to sign up for? You know? So I started to feel weird about it. I love talking about it though, honestly, especially in a situation like this where people know that's like not the case. You know, man, it's really interesting. You know, you kind of mentioned it before, or maybe you just said it briefly, but like, you know, God does things obviously. And what's really going to push it is the kid. I have this baby now. So now it's kind of like, well, I could hang out and just be a weirdo all day. But now I have a situation where I'm like morally responsible for the spiritual development of my child. And, you know, I could just keep it going and be like, yeah, we're just weirdos that don't fit in anywhere. But that kind of sucks. And then like, even if I do say that, even if I'm like, well, yeah, we just kind of, we don't really know. I don't really know, man. I don't know. Like, we have to go to a church. So then that kind of forces the question anyway. And then that's also a weird catch 22. Cause then am I like, well, we'll just go to the church that's closest. And then I'll just tell the kid we go to this church cause it's the closest. I mean, that seems kind of weird. I mean, maybe that's good. I don't know. But that also seems kind of setting myself up for him being like, well, why do we go here though? I mean, you know,
So
it's really interesting. Then there's also other stuff like, you know, let's say I was like, okay, this church is probably the way to go for my family, which is kind of how I'm phrasing it more than me figuring out some ultimate truth, which maybe is a cop out, but that's the more like pressing issue. But if I decide, you know, okay, this is the church that's correct for my family, but it's an hour and a half away, that kind of sucks too, because I'm trying to raise my kid in like a spiritual community, which is kind of the whole point of going to church. So it's like all these different things stack up. To be honest, I'm really wondering how it's going to play out. I mean, I'm the one making the call. But it is interesting because, to be totally honest, one thing I've been wrestling with a lot is the tension I have between – you're going to love this, honestly – is the tension I have between the, like, authority of time and history and passing things down and who has spiritual authority and not letting myself just – be capricious and going on my own whims, which probably naturally results in me justifying XYZ about myself because I'm kind of just winging it, versus I am American and I really don't like people telling me what to do. Honestly, at the end of the day, like I really, and that tension has just been right at like the forefront. And it's funny because now, like I said, I'm hitting the later history stuff with the Reformation and especially the American groups. I've really been focusing on the 1800s in particular. And I'm like, oh, it's not just me. Like, it's not just me. Like, that was a real big historical phenomenon of people coming to America and being like, wow, now we can finally, like, just think for ourselves and not have people tell us what to do and think. And we can read this book and see what it says to us. And, you know, I could be charitable and say every group has, like, positive and negatives, let's say. But that's, like, pretty interesting for me, man. Because, yeah, like I said, at the end of the day, I feel like I've been pushing that off. But yeah, I really am American, and especially like it's an odd parallel, but especially with everything that's been going on the last few years, it's like at the end of the day, if someone tells me to do something and it really doesn't abide with my conscience and what I have come to know about God humbly, like I'm not going to do it. Like I'm literally just not going to do it. So that's a really interesting position to be in, because then it's like, well, am I just going to join a church that's more I know I'm using the wrong word here if anyone's listening that belongs to such an organization, but that's more like spiritual authority, top down people in charge kind of way? Am I just going to join one and hope they never tell me to do anything that I don't want to do? It's kind of a weird bet. So yeah, it's a really interesting time here. I'm getting away with it now because the kid's still a baby, but eventually push will come to shove. And I'll probably just honestly do whatever I feel like is right for my family rather than being like, I figured out which group has the ultimate truth. I think padding it that way makes it a little bit easier. And it'll let me be honest with my kid. I mean, I'll be like, you know, I'm responsible for your spiritual development. In terms of all the other weird stuff we've been talking about, it's a nice like tie-in also, because a lot of people listening probably have kids and have probably wondered this too. But, you know, I did wonder, like, I think a lot of crazy stuff, and I'm pretty sure it's true, but like when I raise the kid, am I going to just tell him point blank, like, you know, here's what we think in this house about X, Y, Z, or, and I think that opening it up to, you know, here's what I think, ultimately you'll have to make your own decision about this, which is interesting too, because that ties into like groups that do infant baptism or not and things like that. You know, it's just been really interesting, man. It's, I don't think it's a coincidence that I've come to all this stuff now that I have a kid. So I'm kind of just floating in that space right now. No answers as usual, just more questions.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pray that the Lord gives you clarity on that. I think you're wise. I mean, just the way you've been talking through it, like in a way that maybe is a check on some of the modern American individualism, although I don't think individualism is necessarily entirely a problem. I think there's some good things there. But like proximity matters. Who am I going to live around, you know, and who am I going to live with in the faith? So I think you've got some good tent poles staked out anyway.
Yeah, man. Thanks.
Yeah. So to maybe to end, and what I'm going to try to do here is say, let me give Owen a chance to talk about anything he finds interesting and see what comes out. So if we go all the way back to Comic X, and you say, yeah, I got into these things that are called conspiracy theories and mainstream culture, but I just think that's a label we stick on stuff that for some reason the mainstream isn't comfortable with yet. And I don't want to put words in your mouth of that. That's my summary. But is there a favorite conspiracy theory or something that you're like, you know what, I 100% believe this is true, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to say very clearly, I think this thing that a lot of people think is crazy is true. Anything like that that come to mind immediately?
Such a good question. People love asking me that. I love it. To be totally honest, I mean, I probably subscribe to, let me put it this way. If you went to like the Wikipedia page for conspiracy theories, you know, and you read them all and you check them all off, you'd probably be closer to my worldview than if you didn't check them all off. Let's put it that way. So there's, you know, things like, you know, shadowy organizations. I mean, obviously I'm 100% down. What other? I kind of forget even what's a conspiracy theory now because I live in this world.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So things like, yeah, shadowy groups and organizations. I mean, that's obviously like 100% real. To hit it really on the head, I think that the most interesting thing for me is that I think will be happening more in the future. It's kind of like breaking now in some weird ways. I normally don't really go into it because it kind of hits this nail, like exactly like in Comic X, where it really, I think that the zeitgeist, I guess you could say, has these like magnets almost. And it's like if you put a piece of metal out, it gets sucked into the magnet. So if you start saying, you know, well, there's X, Y, Z, people are like, oh my God, you mean this other thing? And it's like, no, it's not what I'm getting at. But I think the most interesting thing for me has to do with, it's going to be a messy answer, but there's something about the fact that science has progressed to this point where the individual cannot actually replicate or verify or authenticate certain things that you now basically have to believe to not be a crazy person, which is in and of itself antithetical to the actual endeavor and nature of science. There's something about that that is really, really, really interesting. I mean, just to give an example, like just coming up with one off the top of my head, but like, you know, how do you know this? If you open up a book and the book says the sun's 9 million miles away, I mean, how do you know that? You kind of don't. I mean, you could kind of cope about it and be like, well, it would be crazy for them to lie. And maybe it would be. I don't know. Maybe why would they lie about that? Right. But you yourself aren't going to do the experiment to replicate that and figure it out. So there's this weird space where our modern worldview requires like a faith in certain scientific organizations and groups and practices, and even just the whole endeavor itself, which is antithetical to science, that I find really, really, really interesting. People might ask, you know, how is that like a conspiracy theory? But it kind of fractures out into, you know, how do you know some of these groups are telling you the truth? What if they're just wrong? What if some of their larger presuppositions are faulty And what if, like, along the way something was lost or things like that? I mean, Nikola Tesla kind of like invented the modern world, kind of. And you go in his books and he's like, yeah, I mean, it's all about the ether, like the luminiferous ether. And like all my work is based on ether. But then people tell you now that like the ether was like a mistake and it's not real. So what? Like, that's kind of just weird. Was he just wrong? And then that also fractures out into like, well, then if you adopt, well, I'm just going to believe, you know, what I can empirically verify. You kind of are like a crazy person. I mean, how do you know that the planets aren't really just lights in the sky? I mean, you can see them with a telescope, but you don't really know. I mean, how do you know we've been to this place or that place? And then it also spills back into history, because when you start digging into it, you know, how do you know this event really happened if it was hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, maybe even more recently? So you end up in this really weird space where you're kind of being agnostic about things that people think it's crazy to not be sure about, but you're not really making any claims about it. And you find all these weird little pieces, like pictures of people, you know, rebuilding Stonehenge, which actually exists. Check it out, by the way. Or things like, you know, this historical event only has like, you know, it's in this source and this source, but did it really happen? And I think that that's breaking in the culture in certain ways. I think that flat Earth was like a caricature manifestation of it. Like, I'm not a flat Earth person. I'm not like locked into the Earth, like being flat. But I think it was a manifestation of people starting to ask themselves like questions that they themselves maybe couldn't answer, or that had no answer, or that maybe the answer was, you could be charitable to science and say it was beyond their comprehension. But then that puts you in an interesting place. I mean, if you ask a scientific question and you aren't qualified to understand the answer, should you just believe it then? And isn't that like kind of like what a faith or religion is more than science, right? So It's kind of this really weird nexus of things that I find crazy interesting. And I think especially with what's been going on the last 2 years, you know, it kind of fits in with that in a weird way of like, well, do we just believe these people who are telling us X, Y, and Z about everything? I mean, it would be pathological to distrust everything, maybe, but it would also be pathological to accept everything, maybe. And then, so it is kind of a conspiracy thing. And I think that that is the most interesting, like, fecund ground. It kind of spirals out to give people a more juicy answer. There is also some stuff like, if people search up the term Antiquitech, or there's this thing called Tartaria, mud flood is also a weird thing. There's lots of these really out there, like full on crazy theories about like, this architectural, I'm kind of giving you a long answer, but I hope it's worth it.
Please go on.
Like this architectural feature, like maybe you can find a crazy person who's like, you know, these buildings have domes, right? But they have domes because they were used for something. The way domes reflect sound, this was used for something thousands of years ago. They built it this way for a reason, to serve a purpose. And we just forgot like what that purpose was. And a lot of these architectural features are what we in the design world would call like a skeuomorph. A skeuomorph is when a design feature persists on beyond what it actually represents. So like you go to a save icon in your computer, it's a floppy disk, but we don't use floppy disks anymore.
Sure.
So a lot of these more wild out there ideas are about like, you know, all these pointy points on some of these ancient buildings. Maybe they were used to like harness electricity or something. Or, oh, you know, you go in these buildings and you see these iron fireplaces, like, but you know, these iron fireplaces, they were actually used for this electrical purpose that we kind of like was erased or something. There's lots of really, really wild stuff like that. And then you get into more questions of like, one of my friends is really into this, into like the World's Fair stuff, where it's like, look at this World's Fair. It was in this random city. Look how much electricity it used. They built this whole thing in X number of days. And then they tore it down. This makes no sense. And there's some like videos you showed me where you go to a builder and you're like, how long would it take you to build this? And they say, you know, this long. And they're like, oh, you know, they built this in X number of days. And they're like, that's impossible. But then are you qualified to figure that out? So it's this really weird world of putting a really interesting, strange, agnostic lens on everything from the past and science that, I'm not locked into anything there, but I find it really, really, really interesting. At least even if you just totally washed it all into crazy world from a fiction or art perspective, it's pretty awesome, man. Like imagining that like weather vanes and domes and buildings are remnants of like an ancient technology that we like forgot about, and the ancient people used to like use them for some kind of sound vibration tech or something. I mean, that's just a good time. It's just a great time. But people can look into it. You can look up like Tartaria or Antiquitech. Tartaria is kind of like the gateway, and you'll find some really wild stuff there, but I'm not like 100% on it. I just find it interesting.
Captivating. Yeah, man, that's great. That's a great answer. And I appreciate all the like bibliography you've given me through this episode.
Yeah, for sure.
I think you're right that that's like cracking through. I don't know if you saw a couple of days ago, Elon Musk tweeted this image. It was like sci-fi imagery. And it said, we went to the moon basically with the technology of a calculator. And then that's this exalted being up here. And at the bottom, it's this lowly life form saying, too many tabs open on my Chrome browser is scary for my hardware. Mm-hmm. And like, why do these things seem so daunting that were accomplished in the past? You know, I've got some friends who are like, if God was replicating the Tower of Babel and scattering people, what would it look like in a technologically advanced society? You know, yeah, but this is why I could talk to you for 3 hours. So I will, I guess I'll bring it to a close here. Owen, man, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on. Listener, I will put links in the show notes for you to get all the good stuff he's working on. But, man, Owen, keep up the good work, and I hope you have a great Christmas.
Yeah, thanks, man. This was a really good time. I'll have to come back again sometime soon. And, yeah, thanks for the endorsement and having me on, man. This was really fun.
Well, we would love to have you back anytime, and we're looking forward to seeing what happens with the book, but then what happens beyond that as well.
Cool. Well, thanks, man.
There you go, guys. That was a long one, but in all honesty, I could have went a lot longer. I know I've said it a lot already, but Owen's work is straight up fascinating. You're going to want to pick up Channel One, the first collection of comics. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. I'll also have links to Owen's social media and homepage in there as well, so be sure and give him a follow. Thanks to Owen Cyclops for coming on, and thanks also to all of you out there who helped make this happen by encouraging him to do so. Don't forget to drop by servantsandheralds.com. We have a good thing going over there, not least among the family of podcasts. Church History Matters, Script v. Manuscript, the SBC Underground Podcast, all of those are worth a subscription, and you won't regret giving them a regular listen. I mentioned the content on Servants and Heralds under the heading Our Hideous Strength earlier, and if you like the interview with Owen, I think you'll like that section of the site too. Okay, I'll wrap up there. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for more from your old buddies at Pop Culture Coram Deo. Remember, live every moment as if you are before the Remember, live every moment as if you are before the face of God, because you are. Talk to you next time.